Hello, everybody. Welcome to Book Talk, the podcast from the Scottish Book Trust. I'm Ryan Van Winkle, your host for this episode, and what a pleasure it is to be in your ears today. We've got a really exciting episode for you. Loads of literature is going to be flying into your ears today. We'll be talking to two fantastic comic book artists, Carrie Fransman and Amruta Patil. We've also got Gail Porter, the legendary Gail Porter, will be on the podcast talking about her favorite books. We've got the comedian and writer Natalie Haynes, who's written a brilliant novel called The Amber Fury. But we're going to start the podcast today with a conversation with our old friend Nick Barley. Nick Barley is the director of the Edinburgh International Book Festival, which, as you know, is one of our favorite things in the year. There's hundreds and hundreds of authors and events happening in Charlotte Square in Edinburgh throughout the month of August. Huge events in the big main tent with famous celebrity authors and loads of other things that you might just miss. So I wanted to talk to Nick about what he thought were some of the hidden gems of the festival and to look at some of the special strands that they had curated for 2014. It's always great to talk to Nick about the book festival because he's so passionate and enthusiastic about it, and I am too. So here we are with Nick Barley.
Hi, my name's Nick Barley and I'm director of the Edinburgh International Book Festival.
I'd like to talk through a little bit of the program, find out what you're excited about and what you're intrigued by. Not just the big names, because I know you've got some massive people like George R.R. Martin and Murakami. Those are all sold out, so let's not talk about them. Let's talk about...
So the thing I've got on my desk in front of me here, which is this thing called IDP 2043. And this is a book that we're publishing together with Freight Books. And it follows on from our stripped graphic novels program last year. We've invited six different sets of writers to put together a graphic novel which looks at Scotland in 30 years time. IDP stands for internally displaced people, and it picks up on this fact at the moment of, you know, expulsions, migrations, people who are thrown out by globalized capitalist system and who are no longer kind of able to get access into the so they're extremely wealthy people and extremely poor people, and it imagines that Scotland is full of people who have been displaced, who can no longer live in their ordinary houses because the water levels have risen. The lucky ones have got to live in a tall tower, and the rest are living in shanty towns across Scotland. And so it's a story, a kind of dystopian story of Scotland's future. The writers are fantastic. Some of them are Irvine Welsh, who's written a chapter. Mary Talbot, who together with Brian Talbot won the Costa Prize for their graphic novel Daughter of His Father's Eyes a few years ago. So it's a really exciting graphic novel that we've produced ourselves, and it's a legacy of our stripped program from last year.
That's great. And then does that tie in at all with the other strand that you're doing this year, which I know you're going to be looking at Syria and Iraq and the Middle East a bit more, and focus is one of the strands, which IDPs, when you say IDP, I immediately think of refugees and people who have been obviously displaced for other horrific reasons.
Yeah, well, that's pretty astute of you, Ryan. In fact, what we're trying to do is trying to look at the overlaps between different things happening around the world. So the question of Scotland's future, which I think very often is regarded as almost as a question which is rather inward-looking. In my opinion, it's not. Scotland's future is a question, it's an international question. Scotland fits together with the rest of the world, with Europe and the Middle East. And so the overlap between displaced persons elsewhere and Scotland's future is really important to me. And so for that reason, we've also invited Raja Shahada, the Palestinian lawyer, to look at the Middle East, not just what the future of the Middle East might be, but to try and look at the past and the present and the future of the Middle East, how it was carved up in the way it was after the First World War, what it's like to be there, living there as a writer now, and how various different political, economic and social things can come together to help us think about what the future of the Middle East might be. So it's five separate events with some of the leading writers from the region. So, for example, Samar Yazbek is joining us, the Syrian writer, and she's one of Syria's greatest living writers. And the fact that she's been able to join us has been really, really tricky. But I think it's a very sensible and sensitive discussion about the Middle East. So it's a really important topic, but it relates to the question of Scotland's future. Similarly, I've invited Richard Sennett, who's the professor of sociology at the LSE and at New York University, to look at intellectual ideas which kind of feed into Scotland's future. So he's looking at what he calls turning points for civilization. A grand idea, three big ideas: capitalism, cities, religion. And so in each of those sessions, they're looking at why these big ideas have had such a major influence on human society, human nature. And so if you think about cities, in order for us to be able to live in cities, we had to come to the realization at some point in the past that we could live next door to people who may be different from us, maybe unknown strangers, and that we wouldn't expect to be killed by them or attacked by them or robbed by them. And indeed, we wouldn't expect to kill them or attack them or rob them.
Tell me, because every year there's always these people that, you know, yourself or maybe Stuart Kelly will just grab me and go, have you heard of so-and-so? No, you need to go to this event right now. And so who would you be looking, who are you looking at this year that you're really excited about that you'd think, you know, people probably don't know this name so well, but you have to go and see them.
The novel, which I think, I really hope it will get noticed. Some, you know, some of these things, that you can, there can be brilliant novels which just somehow slide by without people seeing them or hearing about them. The novel which I hope people pick up and read this year is by a Brazilian Jewish writer called Michael Laub, Diary of the Fall. And it turns out that Michael Laub, his grandfather was in a concentration camp, escaped, and they left Germany after the war and went to Brazil. And I had no idea that there was a whole group of Jewish people who went to live in Brazil. And this story, I mean, it starts out appearing like it's going to be a piece of Holocaust literature. And then it says, you know, this is not going to be Holocaust literature. Don't worry. That's really hard to write about. But you need to know that my grandfather was in a concentration camp. And then it goes on really to be a novel, which is about the relationship between a son and his father, trying to sort of understand each other through trauma and beyond trauma and through migration and beyond migration. And so something about the kind of construction of the novel, which is through this series of revelations about the father and about the son and about other things, which I won't say because it would be a spoiler, which is so beautifully constructed and so beautifully moving that I don't think it's just something that sons and fathers would appreciate. This is about human relationships, which is utterly compelling and utterly devastating as it comes towards its conclusion. So Michael Laub, Diary of the Fool, I really want people to go and see that. And what's even better is that we've put him on with Javier Cercas, who's a Spanish writer, a genius Spanish writer. So it's two genius literary writers together in one session.
Tell me one more, just in case people can't get to that particular one, it'd be nice to have a few options.
A book called H is for Hawk, and it's by a young writer called Helen MacDonald, and she's based in England. Essentially, she found out that her father had died and she was going through this period of bereavement. She felt totally unhinged by the fact of her father's death. She felt that she went through a period of madness. And part of that period of what she thought of as kind of mental instability was a strange decision that she had to get herself a goshawk and train it. Okay, and a goshawk, you learn from her memoir, is like the largest of all hawks. It's vicious. It's a killing machine. It's incredibly difficult to train. And so she decided she had to do this. And she gets this goshawk in a box. And in order to try and help her, she goes and looks at the memoir of another writer who wrote a book about a hawk and his failure to train it. And so it's a memoir about bereavement. It's a piece of nature writing about training this goshawk. And it's also a kind of biography of the writer T.H. White. On three different levels, it's incredibly compelling, brilliantly structured, brilliantly written. And I just think if you're looking for somebody who's going to win all of the nonfiction awards this year, she is the most likely candidate of them all. She will be shortlisted for every single one of them for this book. It's so beautifully written. And you just realize actually that good writers are observers of the world. You know, they can look at something and make oddball connections between, you know, a writer from the 1930s, the father's death, and a piece of, you know, an animal, and just weave something extraordinary out of it. It's beautiful.
And it turns out you're totally enthralled by it and interested in it. And I think that's the exciting thing about the entire program.
One last thing, which is a project which is very dear to my heart, is called Conversations with Ourselves. And not only is it a piece of festival programming, it's also an attempt to understand the creative process more closely. Conversations with Ourselves is a collaboration with Durham University and the Wellcome Trust, which looks at inner voices, or it listens to inner voices and thinks about inner voices and what they mean. So traditionally, inner voices have been regarded as psychopathological. You know, if you're hearing voices, it's something you don't want, and people often get treatment for schizophrenia, or it's regarded as schizophrenia. But that's an old-fashioned conception of inner voices. Increasingly now, people are realizing that voice hearing doesn't have to be a psychopathological problem. It can also be something very useful and indeed possibly very helpful for the creative process. After all, if you think about what a novelist has to do, a novelist has to try to channel characters into voices, which even if they can't literally hear them in their head, then in some way they're accessing those voices, the voices of characters, so they can put them on the page. A character, a dialogue in a character has to be different from what what the author actually thinks in order to be a credible character. Otherwise, it's simply facets of all different facets of the author, not credible. So our project is both to ask writers about inner voices and what they mean to them and how they use them for the creative process, but also to put together a piece of academic research into the creative process. And so there's a paper that's gone out, which all the participants in the program are being asked to fill in, to talk about how voices, how they hear voices, whether they had an imaginary friend as a child, whether they've ever had some kind of epiphany, you know, maybe felt that they've heard something literally, or whether they've ever heard what they thought was a phone ringing somewhere, or whether they try and channel themselves into that kind of state through things like alcohol, drugs, or any other kind of imbibing of substances, which to help them to generate these voices. So it's a project which throws up about 6 or 7 events in the program with writers talking about these issues, but it also contributes to scientific and academic learning.
Yeah, that's amazing. I got the email today. This is the first, right? Nobody's ever kind of studied this idea. And I think it's really important, because when you look at mental illness and the way we stigmatize mental illness, I think these are just, to me, it's always seemed like, oh, I have a bit of that, and I just am able to manage it and control it better. And I think, and focus it on writing or the work I do, whereas some people aren't so lucky to have that opportunity. But it doesn't seem to me to be like inherently negative to have a bit of an imagination and hear people talking to you.
Yeah, that's right. And obviously, nobody involved in the project wants to deny that sometimes hearing voices can be a problem for people. Nobody wants to pretend that it isn't a problem for some. But the idea is that there's some kind of spectrum of voice hearing, which goes from the psychopathological right through to the creative and productive and something to celebrate. You know, if you manage to hear a voice, then that can be useful in terms of producing something good and imaginative.
Nick Barley, everybody. We could have talked about the authors that are going to be at the Edinburgh International Book Festival for about 2 weeks, I'm sure. You can find out all about it at edbookfest.co.uk or follow along on their Twitter at edbookfest. And while we're speaking of Twitter, why don't you follow us too? We'll give you loads of great news and tips of places to go and tell you about what books we're reading at Scottish BK Trust. If you're more of a Facebook person, you could like our Facebook page. Just look for us there on the Facebook, or check out our website with loads and loads of materials and interactive things happening on it. You can look for us on www.scottishbooktrust.com. We hope to see you at one of these places. One thing Nick Barley didn't mention was Natalie Haynes is going to be at the book festival. She's written a very interesting book called The Amber Fury. It's her debut novel, so it was a real pleasure to have her on the podcast to tell us about it. Here she is, Natalie Haynes.
I'm Natalie Haynes, and I wrote a book called The Amber Fury. It's quite a sad book, I'm not going to lie to you. It's about Greek tragedy, I suppose. It's centres on a woman whose name is Alex Morris, who has suffered a terrible, terrible tragedy in London, where she lives, and she can't cope with it, so she runs away from her real life back to Edinburgh, which is where she was a student, and she gives up her job in order to go back to the thing that she's technically qualified to do, which is teach drama and drama therapy at a unit for children who've been referred from schools, i.e. thrown out of school for misbehaviour. And she teaches them Greek tragedy, because these damaged, angry teenagers hate everything that she suggests, and then she suggests Greek tragedy because they have a pile of books and it's the only one that no one knows enough about to hate. And so she teaches them that, and of course it turns out that damaged, angry teenagers know a great deal about being a damaged, angry person in a Greek tragedy, and a whole new modern day Greek tragedy plays out before her very eyes.
So the beginning, and that beginning scene is really elegantly done, where they're just in that basement, she's looking at the five of them on Rankeillor Street in Edinburgh, right? Yeah, where I have friends who have lived there, and I could perfectly picture it. But like, there's this whole thing that's going to happen with her students and her, and then you're kind of working in the whole Greek tragedy and the education of these students at the same time, right?
Yes, yeah. That's exactly it. I think that Greek tragedy is something that teenagers kind of instinctively understand. It's where I first came across Greek tragedy, was when I was a teenager, and those very extreme emotions that exist all the time in Greek tragedy. Oedipus, he's super clever, but it makes him bad-tempered. It makes him too quick-witted, but then quick-tempered. Or Antigone, she's loyal to her brother, she's too loyal. Loyal to a fault. You know, we can eventually say, somebody does say to her, she's in love with death. And so I think those extremes of emotion, it works perfectly with teenagers. So Yes, I think they do learn something from Alex during this book, but I think it's fair to say that one of her students learned something she was very much not intending to teach.
But it's interesting because I feel the same exact way about students in poetry as well. Like, young people have a good sense of that, like, hyper emotion, I guess, that hyper emotional state, yeah. hyper intense state, which I think is also inherent in these kind of tragedies that you're talking about, which is they haven't found the balance.
You feel everything so much when yeah. you're young, and nothing, you know, I can't remember whose thesis it is that everyone's favorite book or album or film is something they saw as a teenager. It's hard to think of many people who could thwart that system. We do tend to feel very passionately about everything, about, you know, it's not just a kind of condescending, oh, first love or whatever. The emotions that I felt as a teenager were pure because you don't have to other stuff to kind of fit around them. You don't have other responsibilities particularly. You just have being alive and trying to work out how to be an adult to deal with. So yeah, I think there's a real purity to the emotions that teenagers feel, which the rest of us are probably glad to be rid of. But actually, I think there's a lot to be said for it.
In setting up and setting out to write this book, how did that come about? Was it starting from the point of like, I want to, you know, you want to write a thriller that has some of these elements of the classicism? Was it by reading Greek tragedies and realizing that, oh, actually, these are models for the way a modern story could be told, and that kind of convergence of connections.
I very much wanted to write something which looked at the ideas of guilt and revenge and forgiveness. I am not as forgiving a person as I would like to be. I'm always really inspired by people who can be very forgiving. You know, when you see somebody on the news who's had this sort of terrible tragedy befall them, and they are extraordinarily kind of clear-eyed and able to say to somebody, oh, you know, I forgive you, I elect to forgive you. The ability to forgive is something which requires, I think, enormous discipline, but I think maybe there's also a sort of talent involved in it. I think it's much easier, to my way of thinking, that you would want to take revenge. And in fact, I'm terrible at taking revenge because my long-term memory is ill-designed for that. So I always mean to. You know, when someone slights you in the past, I think, oh, one of these days, and then, of course, I forget about it, and then the next time I say, oh, hi, oh, I'm terrible at bearing a grudge. But in my head, I like the idea of being a person who can bear a grudge. So this book was always kind of inspired by the idea of if something terrible happened to somebody who just couldn't move on, who not only couldn't forgive, but who couldn't move at all from a place of terrible bereavement, what would they do? How would their life work? You can't just, you know, bills have to get paid. So what would this person end up doing? And so that's sort of where it started. It's never a very long way for me to go from something terrible has befallen you and you don't know how to cope with it to Greek tragedy, where terrible things befall people all the time and people cope with it in all manner of extremely deviant fashions. And so that's where it began.
And that's how Alex ends up in Edinburgh, right?
Yes. Yeah. It's really a personal thing for me that both times I was bereaved in my 20s, I was either in or on my way to Edinburgh because I used to be on tour all the time because I was a comedian. So I suppose statistically, it was quite likely that that would happen. But I was on my way to Edinburgh when I got the message saying that my grandfather had died. And I was on stage in Edinburgh. I came off to find voicemail saying that my grandmother, who was in hospital but was going to be fine, was in fact going to be dead by the end of the week. And I remember running, literally running across the city. It was all very cinematic, to the Stand Comedy Club on York Place, because I'd been gigging at the Pleasance. Because in those days, people's phones didn't have the internet. And I had to run to there to find a computer where I could book a flight for first thing the next morning so I could get to where my grandmother was dying in time to see her before she died. And so to me, Edinburgh is absolutely a place where you go to when something terrible has happened and then people are nice to you. I always think of it as a place with a forbidding facade. You know, everything is grey, everything is big, everything is sort of on a huge scale. The doors are enormous, the ceilings are high, the gravestones are huge. And you just go, how? Were they a race of giants who lived in Edinburgh before now? I've never understood it. I love it. But behind these angry, grey, forbidding facades are people who are enormously kind to you in your time of need. And that's exactly where I needed to send Alex.
I guess that maybe that highlights something that's actually in the book, which is this great tragedy, adversity, stress, kids in bad situations, main character who's bereaved and running away, but also a sense of humor and there's some fun there, right?
There's not as much fun as I think people will probably expect given my former profession. I some people who've read it, who are kind of more maybe finely tuned to it, have gone, actually, it's a much funnier book than I was expecting. And I'm glad of that because I think terrible things happen to people who are funny too. And there's a great temptation to believe in fictional representations of people that essentially you are no more than the sum of I'm sad because a bad thing happened to me. But before the bad thing happened to you, you might have been hilarious. You might have been funny and complicated and interesting. And it was always a kind of battle for me as it, when I was still a comic, that, you know, sometimes awful things happened, like my grandmother dying, and then I had to go on stage and be hilarious the next day. And that's exactly as hard as it sounds. I like the idea. I think it's underrepresented in writing in general, and certainly in writing from the UK. The idea that horrible things happen to people who are in real life and normally quite funny or witty or something like that. I think that deserved writing.
And people you deal with tragedy through humor. I mean, that shouldn't be shocking. I don't understand why it should be shocking on the page or resisted on the page, as, you know, you can go to a funeral and have a pretty good laugh.
Yeah, I think that's true. I was always very keen to embrace the idea of dealing with the worst parts of my life in a funny way when I was a comic. With this, I think, you know, Alex is probably beyond the level of funny, but I think anyway that as she sort of defrosts during the novel, as she comes back to life, you get these kind of glimpses, these just moments of the fact that she was once funny and charmed by people. And I think she is charmed by these bad kids that she's teaching. I like them, and I can't deny it.
You talked about being a comic and editing and then poetry and this kind of concision. And I've been thinking a lot about, because I watch a lot of stand-up comedy and I've always been a huge fan of it, and I happen to write poems. And I've always thought, like, a really good stand-up comic and a really good poet often have a lot in common, because it's about clarity of image and being able to just using words to get an image into somebody's head. The sense of surprise and the need for this pause and the surprise and the way something turns. And I think maybe that's partly what happens in this book with the turn of the story and the change in the story and the suspense of it, the twist.
So. Yeah, I hope so. I hesitate to take us from Greek tragedy to Roman satire, but it's irresistible to me now we've talked about comedy. My absolute favourite two-word turn is in Juvenal, the Roman satirist Juvenal, where he talks about somebody offering him inuriam cani, the insult of dinner. And you, oh man, it just slams the two words into each other. It's like only Juvenal would really be able to, not just that somebody gave him a dinner that wasn't nice, but they offered him the insult of dinner, and that's perfect.
Yeah.
That's just perfect. So yeah, I think there's a reason why comedians are still trying to create that. I mean, obviously he was both a comedian and a poet, so always trying to find the most succinct way of saying something pointed, and always trying to create those phrases where, you know, they're kind of burned into your retina the moment you see them. You just think, oh, that's so good.
Stand-up routine doesn't work like a novel, where there's a story, there's a sequence of emotions, feelings, jokes, I guess, but like little mini vignettes, as opposed to like a whole novel.
Thing. But then there are some stand-ups, like Tommy Tin, and I guess would leap instantly to mind, who is he's a proper storyteller. You know, this is storytelling in its purest form, oral storytelling. You know, there are probably connections there. I'm sure that some of the storytelling that I learned to do on stage, the hard way, obviously, because that's the best way to learn something, I hope that that's spilled over into this book. The keeping information until the last possible minute. I didn't particularly set out to write a thriller, but I hope that this works. This works at two levels, I hope. I hope it works as a, you know, relatively cerebral literary novel full of Greek tragedy, and I hope it also works as a page turner, as a thriller. But I hope that withholding it until the last possible minute, that's a stand-up technique for sure.
Nelly Haynes, everybody. You can catch her at the Edinburgh Book Festival alongside Helen Walsh on the 21st of August. Because The Amber Fury is her first book, she's been nominated for the prestigious First Book Award. So she'll be talking about that at this event, as well as a whole host of other things. You can catch her on the 21st of August in the Spiegel Tent. Now, earlier on in the podcast, Nick Barley was talking about the strands of the Edinburgh International Book Festival, which I always really enjoy. And last year, they had a comic book strand, a whole strand of the Edinburgh International Book Festival dedicated just to graphic novels. And it was brilliant, because I love those things. And we were really lucky, because we got to talk to two great graphic novelists, Carrie Fransman and Amruta Patil. They were up in Dundee, and this interview is conducted by Peggy Hughes of Literary Dundee.
My name's Carrie Fransman, and I'm in Dundee with Scottish Pen and Dundee Literature Festival.
I'm Amruta Patil, and I'm here to speak graphic novels and mythology and surrealism in comics made by women.
Carrie, can you tell us a little bit about your book, The House That Groaned?
It's a graphic novel set in a big Victorian house which has six inhabitants living in it. The story's about the house which is slowly decaying inside, electricity failing, the lights are not working, and these incidents force the lonely inhabitants out of the flat and into contact with each other. Essentially, it's a book all about people's relationships with their bodies.
I wrote the same question about your two titles.
My first book, Kari, is an urban contemporary surreal tale set in Mumbai with a queer protagonist and a city which is practically another of the characters of the book. And my second book, Adi Parva, is part of a sequence of books based on the Mahabharata, which is an ancient Indian epic, and the oral tradition of storytelling which exists in my country.
And I wonder if I could ask you about your influences in your graphic work. I guess other artists who have influenced you when you were readers growing up, or basically how you came to be doing what you're doing.
I've got so many. So I think my influences definitely are people who sit on the boundaries between art and storytelling. My biggest influences were children book writers, picture book writers. So for me, that was definitely Maurice Sendak, and then Kit Williams, who did brilliant Masquerade, which was really interactive before its time. But the writers, I guess, who I love are very visual. So Toni Morrison and Margaret Atwood and people like that.
I didn't grow up reading comics or graphic novels, so my own influences do not come from the world of graphic novels, but from other places. In the literary sense, I think my influences come from mythology, from history, from things like that. Artistically, they come from a gamut of dead men, master painters, people ranging from Yusuf Banglorwala, who was someone who did Amar Chitra Katha comics in India back in the 80s and 70s, to people like Frida Kahlo, to Dave McKean. A very, very miscellaneous bunch.
Fab. Both very broad-ranging. I've actually just thought of one, because I think a lot of our listeners are budding writers, budding artists themselves. So I'm just going to ask, have you got any advice you would have given to your younger selves starting out on this track? And Amrita, I'll come to you first.
To my younger self, I would have said that don't apologize for what you see as setbacks, because you may go on to discover that those are in fact assets and not setbacks. Being somebody from a small town setting, being someone that doesn't know what's trendy or doesn't know the grammar, that's how you innovate and you come up with voices that are different.
Okay, so I'd probably say that you should rack up your number of rejections as well and not be scared. I think I've had probably more rejections than most people, which is probably why I've had more successes than most people. And I think you just really have to put yourself out there and not worry too much about it and not lose the love of what you're doing, the actual joy of being in front of a piece of paper and making something with your hands. I think, yeah, if you lose that, then you might as well be working in a bank.
Kerry Fransman and Amrita Patil, everybody. Check out their work. They're both fantastic artists. And you're going to love their stuff if you see it in person. And thanks again to Peggy Hughes of Literary Dundee for grabbing that interview. And lastly, we're going to close the podcast today with Gail Porter. Gail Porter was at the I Write Festival in Glasgow. We got to meet her in the dark stacks of the Mitchell Library, which I was using as a makeshift recording studio. And we had a brilliant conversation. Gail was just talking about the books she loves, and we thought that would be a perfect way to end this podcast. So here she is, Gail Porter.
Gail Porter, just been talking about the books that kind of like sculpted my life and things that I really enjoyed. And it's really difficult because you cannot, you know, I was allowed to have 5 books and you can't do 5 books.
Now, do you do the thing that I do whenever anybody asks me about my favorite poems, books, songs, and almost kind of anything? I immediately go back to being like 18, 20 years old, like really young.
Yeah, I think I went back to 16 and I've literally been sitting in cafes for like the past week reading. I did my research. It was literally like being back at school.
Which books would you have mentioned?
The main books were A Confederacy of Dunces by John Kennedy Toole, Perfume by Patrick Susskind, Where the World Things Are by Maurice Sendak, also Trainspotting by Irvine Welsh, of course. He's a legend.
When you were rereading these books, did you, because I can remember, like, there's 2 books in my life that I remember very distinctly having 2 very different impressions of rereading, which one was Catcher in the Rye and the other was Notes from the Underground. Very similar.
Amazing books. Absolutely amazing books.
And did you find that when you read them as a kid, you were like, anti-hero, these guys, and you read them as an adult, they're jerks. Those are horrible people.
It's so amazing to read a novel when you're a kid and when you read it when you get older and you just think, wow, your perspective is just totally different. But, you know, I still kind of look at my books and I quite like my 16-year-old self and I quite like the way that I look at that book, if that makes any sense to you.
Yeah. I like the fact that you went with Where the Wild Things Are, which is an amazing piece of work.
Well, I think Maurice Sendak was an absolute genius. And do you know what? It's such a complex book, although it's so simple. This little boy that just goes away, you know, he's not gone away for a minute. He's gone away for an hour, then a year, then a month. Then it was such a weird book, but amazing. And
amazing, and it doesn't take very long to read.
It doesn't take long to read at all, but it's a beautiful imaginary fantasy that we can all be in. And the thing is, I was a proper dreamer when I was a kid, so every time I read it, I think that was me. I was on that boat.
Have you thought about how these books, the books that like you named or were thinking about before you had to give this talk, did you think a bit about how they had affected your life in ways that you hadn't realized before?
No, I actually think I've always kept them by my bed. Yeah, no, I always have a list of books by my bed that I am actually in love with.
Gail Porter, everybody, I'm so glad she took the time to talk with us. Thanks so much to her and everybody who's been on the podcast today. Nick Barley, Natalie Haynes, Carrie Fransman, and Amruta Patil. Go seek out their work wherever you can find it. And now that the podcast is finished, I want you to rip your earbuds out and go outside with a book, lay down in the park, and relax. Read something. Enjoy the rest of your day.